You are not alone. And now there are two resources that I've put together specifically for your journey. This is your host, Rachel Bernstein. I am an educator and a therapist and a cult specialist. And I am very excited to announce Restart and Restore, a journal for survivors of manipulation, and a companion notebook that I've put together to go with it that has people's stories that they've shared with me that they wanted to share with you, and some wonderful quotes from people whose thoughts I truly admire, and more pages and writing prompts for you to continue with the writing that can help you along your healing journey. This isn't just another blank journal. It's a trauma-informed recovery companion, and it offers psychoeducation on the mechanics of manipulation and control and therapeutic writing prompts to explore your history and your strengths, practical exercises that transform insights into some actionable steps, and the freedom to heal at your own pace. You can do it in the time frame that works for you without any judgment or pressure. Whether you joined the organization or the relationship that was controlling as a teen or as an adult, Restart and Restore provides the structure and, I think, validation needed to process your experiences safely. I'm also excited to share, beyond the journal and its companion notebook, that I'm currently working on a second journal specifically for those born and raised in high-control groups or high-control family units, as their healing journey often involves different and specialized challenges. Restart and Restore and its companion notebook are available now, and you can find the link in the show notes. Thank you very much. I hope it's helpful to you or to someone you love. One of the questions someone asked me was, how do you actually protect yourself from love bombing when it feels so good in the moment? My answer might surprise you. And I give this answer in my new Q&A video on Patreon. Recently, Patreon supporters got something that I haven't provided before, a full exclusive Q&A where I answered your most personal or your most pressing questions about coercive control, building healthy community, about the things that don't leave visible marks but can change everything in your psyche, in your life. They are real questions with real answers. And here's the thing. That conversation is already live right now. Patreon members are listening to it. And if you're not one of them, you're missing out. So these are the conversations that don't make it into regular episodes. Those kind of nuanced questions, the specific questions, the stuff you actually want to know directly. That's what Patreon is for, among many other things. And I plan to do more of these because it was very popular. People were really wanting to ask some questions that they haven't had a chance to ask before. So if you've ever wished you could just ask me something directly, now you can. Join at the link in the show notes and you'll get access to this Q&A, plus everything else, all the bonus episodes, etc., that I'm building over there. Take good care.
Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Hello, everyone. Today on the show, we have a special guest, someone who is a listener of the podcast, someone who is going to come on to talk about something we haven't actually covered from this perspective yet on the show. Louise Williamson grew up in the UK and moved to New Zealand with her now ex-husband when she was in her early 20s. Together, they built a family, a business, and what she thought was a shared future. And then he vanished down a conspiracy rabbit hole that turned Louise's life completely, completely upside down. Having stepped away from the family business, Louise is reclaiming her life, rediscovering her own interests, and taking on the challenge of building a new career as a writer in midlife. Louise has spent a great deal of time studying conspiracy theories, what they are, how they originated, and how they work, and is committed to sharing this knowledge in a way that incorporates her lived experience. You can find her online at www.louisewilliamsonwriter.com. And her Substack is louisewilliamson2.substack.com/. We're also going to put her social media in the show notes. And check out her book, My Husband, The Rabbit Hole, and Me, When Marriage Becomes a Cult. It's available on Amazon or via her website. Here's Louise now. I am so happy to be able to introduce all of you to Louise Williamson today, who is going to be sharing about a subject that will be taking in different directions, but it's something that really, really needs to be covered, I think, a lot more often than it is in the news. And we've had people on the show in the past talking about their involvement in QAnon and other groups like it, and talking about when they came to, when they felt like the trance was starting to wear off and what caused them to get involved and what caused them to leave. But we haven't heard yet from the others, from the ones who are impacted by being with someone, loving someone, caring about someone who gets pulled into this whole realm. And it's a whole realm. It's a whole world. It's a whole way of thinking. It's a whole way of thinking about the world. It's a whole way of thinking about yourself in the world. And so it's huge. It really is huge. And so I really value you coming onto the show and talking about this. And I would love for you to take a moment to introduce yourself to the listeners.
Thank you, Rachel. That was a lovely introduction. I'm Louise Williamson. I grew up in the UK and moved to New Zealand when I was in my early 20s, and I have lived here ever since. I was very young when I met my ex-husband, and we got married unfashionably young at the time and spent several decades together in what seemed to be a relatively happy and normal family life. And we moved to Wellington from one of New Zealand's smaller cities in 2011. And it was after that point that I noticed that there'd been a change in the conversation topics that we might have at morning tea time or something like that. That was followed fairly soon afterwards by an overall change in demeanor and a change in the way the two of us interacted. Some of the stories that I was being told were becoming increasingly bizarre and dark. Initially, I didn't know what a conspiracy theory was. I didn't recognize these stories as conspiracy theories, but it was only after they kept coming that I went away and looked a few things up that I was able to join those dots and recognize what was going on. I first became aware of it around about 2014. It may well have started before that. That was just the time when it became obvious to me. It was pretty much all of the major grand conspiracy theories more or less, you name it, he believed it. Hollow Earth, not. But apart from that, there weren't many things that were off the table. And I kept trying to rationalize it to myself and wondering whether there was any truth in it, whether there was something that I'd missed. What I found was the more I looked into it all, the more unlikely it all seemed. So my efforts to try and understand him better and to join him actually ended up pushing me further away, because I just couldn't see any validity to any of it at all, whereas he wasn't prepared to budge or see that. It started pushing us further apart, but still then I was trying to find ways to justify it to myself and to remain in the relationship, because anyone who's ended a long-term relationship would know that that's not something that you do on a whim. You look for reasons to stay rather than reasons to leave. So I had several years of doing that, and then COVID happened. And it was during the pandemic that things took a turn for the worse in our household. And I also had the advantage of being able to have an outside world perspective on what was going on inside my own house. And I think that was what began the process of the gaslight being blown out for me.
There is something so interesting also about what you mentioned about that this happened around the time of a move. Sometimes people will ask me what kind of person gets involved in some cultic group, conspiratorial thinking, or sometimes there's a lot of overlap, a cultic conspiratorial kind of group. And my answer, well, I can certainly get into the kind of personality traits that I see that overlap, but it's been expanded to not just so much of a what is true about that person kind of answer, but it includes a when kind of answer, that there are these moments in our lives that are transitional moments. And it could be that that turns things upside down or causes people to feel like things are shifting under their feet and they don't feel comfortable with that, or that they've reached a certain milestone or a certain birth date, or something happens where they can attribute it to a certain kind of timing. So I'm curious about that. And you've also already highlighted something that I've seen time and time again with these kinds of stories, where it isn't an all-inclusive thing. It's very much an us versus them. You are then the enemy as the naysayer. Knowing that that's where you're going to be headed is, of course, going to make you delay being a naysayer. You want to take it on for size. I hear if you're with someone who's potentially bright, capable in these other areas of their lives, then there must be something to this. I like that you took that on for size, that you kind of showed that you were willing to look and to see, and that based on that, you could then make, after you did your digging, you could then make a more, what I think is a more educated, not just a reactive guess or plan, but more educated one about what you were going to believe and what you weren't based on what you uncovered and what seemed true and what wasn't. I think that that says a lot about you as a partner, that you were willing to do that work just to see maybe there is something to this. Although that doesn't get appreciated.
Not at all.
Not at all. Because you didn't change your mind. That's the only thing that would matter to a person who has now this dichotomy, this us versus them, black and white kind of thinking. You are then part of the problem.
That's an interesting point, because it took me a little while to realize that I was the enemy, as in several years. And I think, to be fair to him, I wasn't viewed as the enemy straight away. I think there was still some hope. The favorite phrase was, well, I hope you come to see this in time, which I found excruciatingly patronizing. But there was a lot of hope on his side that I would eventually wake up.
even just the wake up idea, right? That somehow you're sleeping and they have their eyes open. They have woken up to the truth and everyone else is in the dark and everyone else is still with blinders on. It is very patronizing, no question.
In terms of the when and the circumstances, there were some factors in our experience that correlate with a lot of what the researchers say. There was a major move from one city to another. There was lots of time alone in that we'd set up a business and were working alone. So there weren't other colleagues around, I suppose, to keep things in check. My mother-in-law had become unwell around that time, and the two of them were always very close. Those are three classic triggers, I think, for that sort of thing.
Yeah, people will talk about, in terms of the timing, they'll say either they were diagnosed with something or someone they love and care about was diagnosed with something that also shook their foundation. It's interesting. Check, check, check. These are the things we see over and over again. Very interesting. So the other part is about there was sort of nothing he didn't disbelieve after a while. He was sort of open to so many different ideas. There are colleagues of mine, Pat Ryan and Joe Kelly, who talk about yes steps. They talk about when you get involved in, sometimes people will do this in marketing or multi-level marketing, cultic groups. If they can get you on board in the first step where you say, oh, yeah, I could see that. And then once you're in the algorithm, and this is what you're getting online, there are these other steps that become easier to make, these logical leaps, because you've already started working up the ladder and you've already been open to something that you might not have been open to before as a possibility. And it just opens up this whole world of things that you would have said, oh, no, that actually sounds pathological. I mean, that sounds diagnosable when people believe these things, but suddenly it feels all potentially real. And so I'm wondering if that's the way it worked for him, that he started small and then was just open to more and more and more. Or were you not a part of those steps? Did you see it sort of farther along?
I think I saw it further along because it's one of the things that I do talk about. I'm not quite sure whether the first thing that he talked to me about was the Hampstead hoax in the UK, or whether it was 9/11. They were both, timing-wise, happened in our conversations around the same time. Those were the first things that he talked to me about, and they were both extreme. There were a variety of 9/11 truth theories. The one that he opted for was the one that was too extreme for a lot of 9/11 truthers. He was talking to me about Judy Wood's work, and she talks about a process of dustification and that the towers were carefully removed using directed energy beams and basically reduced to dust. A lot of conspiracy theories have an internal spectrum of their own. On the 9/11 spectrum, his was already at the extreme end of that spectrum by the time he started talking to me about it. But it took me several years to work that out, of finding the time to look into it and understanding more about it. So at the time he was talking to me about it, I didn't realize quite how extreme it was. It was really hard. So that was back in 2014, 2015. There may well have been a gradual on-ramp. It wasn't one that I was aware of.
Now that you're saying that, I think there are a lot of people who will say, oh, I just heard from my loved one that they've just started getting involved in something. They're already going to a workshop, or this is their new circle of friends, or I've noticed that they're speaking with different kinds of wording, but it seems that they've just gotten involved, and it's usually not the case that it was a just. That there was a long time in coming that they've been worked on, that they've developed this new lexicon, that they have a whole group of people who they are connecting to. And that farther along the way, that's when they introduce the idea to others, knowing that they might get pushback. And often from people I've talked to who have left those environments, they say that they felt like they needed to get to a point where they were sure, where they could argue their points, and they felt like they had enough proof, which is always so interesting to think of the word proof along with conspiracy theories, whatever proof means there. You might not often see the first steps. I just wonder what it was like for you now that we are lucky enough to be speaking to the person who this was impacting in those moments. If you don't mind taking us back to some of these moments where he was speaking in a way where you were probably thinking, who is this person? What were those moments like for you?
That didn't happen straight away. I have a fairly vivid recollection of being told about what I now know to be the Hampstead hoax, except that I didn't know that that's what it was at the time, being told about this poor Russian woman who was treated very badly and the amount of children that go missing every year in the UK and how difficult it is to get them back. I just remember feeling, oh, how awful that must have been, terrible for them. And then thinking, but why are you so involved in it? Why are you spending so much time on something that is nothing to do with you, that you can't do anything about, and it's not going to affect your day-to-day life, and you could be using that energy for other things? After a while, I mean, it might have been a few weeks or a few months, as the conversations were getting more and more intense, what I started thinking more often was, why is he making himself so upset about these things and getting so involved and getting so worked up when really it has nothing to do with us? I think wanting to help people and change the world for the better are obviously perfectly laudable aspirations, but I tend to prefer to do it small and help a few people close to me in a way that I can see or in a practical way, rather than something nebulous and in the distance that's so much harder to even have any impact on. So I think I was just looking at ways of helping the world and making things better in a completely different way from him. And I do remember having conversations with him about that, but they didn't go anywhere. I think that's it, really. I couldn't understand why he was getting so upset about something so far away and also something relatively intangible.
I'm now remembering also speaking to a woman years ago who got very involved in the Save the Children idea that was very much tied in with Pizzagate and that whole scene.
And the Hampstead hoax was part of that as well.
So much crossover. And Save the Children is an actual organization. And so I don't mean for people to not care about that organization and give to that organization. But I remember saying to this woman who was barred from PTA meetings because she would lunge at people from across the town. Like, she became hostile, saying that at the children's school that they were not saving the children. And I remember saying to her at some point, because she really did care, it came from this place of really caring, I said, how many children do you feel like you've saved and where are they? And she said, I don't know what you mean. I said, I know that you care. You are a parent. And this is coming from a place of really wanting to save lots of children through an organization, let's say, where you donate or you work at a foster care agency or some. There's this tangibility. I get to meet those children, or I get to see within an organization, the pictures of the children within a village where the thing that I'm donating is going towards, and I can actually go visit there if I wanted. But it was this amorphous children thing. And there was this moment of silence where she had to think, I actually don't know. I don't know if this is going anywhere. So I remember saying to her, you have a wonderful heart, and I want it to be directed so that it really is helping, not just that you're yet another voice in an organization that might be just about being loud, but not really helping. And that's when our conversations ended, because I think she may have needed to go and think about that.
That's really good if you did manage to get her to stop and think. During the pandemic, when my then husband was working with some other people in New Zealand, who I'm not going to name, about writing articles and producing videos with a lot of anti-vax material and COVID contrarian material and that sort of thing. We had a very, very ugly argument one evening when I had expressed displeasure at the fact that he had been publishing these things behind my back without talking to me about it first. And it got very ugly very quickly. And he was telling me that I had no empathy because I didn't care that children were dying. And this went on for a little while. And then I stopped and asked him how many lives he'd saved through this. And he just waved it away. Oh, it's impossible to put a number on it. Didn't stop and think for one moment. I had heard somewhere else that that is quite a useful way of getting people to stop and think, but it was too late for him. But just coming back to the earlier question about what it was like in the early days, I did used to ask him how it would all work when he'd be talking about they are going to do this and when they do that, and talking about the FEMA camps in the US and they'll declare martial law and put everyone in these camps. And I would say, well, who are they? How would it work? Some of those very basic questions. At that time, coming from a place of actually thinking that I'd missed something, because I respected his intelligence and his integrity so much, that I actually thought that I'd missed something and I didn't understand. So I was trying to get him to explain. It wasn't actually to catch him out. That's the thing that I do hold on to, that I was coming from a place of genuinely wanting to understand, but he couldn't explain it. I still don't. Well, I mean, I found out who they might be from my own looking into it, but he couldn't explain at the time.
Here you were genuinely curious and really wanting to know and to understand, and coming from a place of seeing him as bright and seeing him as having integrity, which is a really lovely word to use towards someone, but that you are the enemy. And it feels so unfair. It is unfair for the others. And you were really being genuine. I'm wondering also what happens socially, because within a relationship, you have a social network and already you had a move. So there could have been a shift in what a friend group would have been. But with family and friends, what were you noticing as he was progressing farther and farther into this world?
I can't remember exactly at what point, but, you know, there was some time during that 2014 to 2019 period where I had made it clear to him that I was worried about pushing people away, that people may find his views off-putting. And he knew that I was worried about that. I do have a recollection of being in some social situations where I would be worrying about what he was saying to people. I almost, not literally looking over my shoulder, but it's that sort of vibe of never being able to fully relax in a social situation because I'd be worried about what he was saying. And I'm not naturally forthright and opinionated. He tends to see the world in black and white, whereas black and white is very rare for me. Like, I can see all of the shades of grey in the middle. And if there are 30 people in a room, all with a different opinion, I'll see merit in all of them. Even if he was saying things that people might find objectionable, I would still find it difficult to contradict him completely because I could see the grain of truth in it, or I could see the bit of it that had merit. I've learnt the hard way that that's not actually a personality flaw. Sometimes I thought it was. I can see now that it's actually really good to have doubt and to see valid points all around. But when you're dealing with somebody like that, it does put you at a disadvantage because I wouldn't say outright, you're wrong and be quiet. I was well aware that some of the opinions expressed were so strident and forceful, and he would get quite worked up about it all. Over time, I became aware that everyone knew. Like, I was really worried with the conspiracy theories that he would be talking to people outside of the house about it. I remember thinking, well, it's all right so long as he only talks to me about it. But then as time went on and I had basically come to the conclusion that I didn't believe any of it and I didn't want to talk about any of it anymore, part of me hoped that he would stop. But there was also a part of me that knew that that wasn't the case and was then worrying about where it was going, knowing that there would have to be some kind of outlet for it. And because I'd made it so clear that I didn't like it and I didn't want to talk about it, then he wouldn't be telling me where it was going. So it had been driven underground. I know that there was one good friend, somebody that I've known all my adult life, that actually grew up in the same town in England that I did and then moved to this part of the world as well. And we used to see him and his wife and daughter reasonably regularly because they had family here and they'd come call in and see us. And then he would reply to messages, but it would take a lot longer than before, and the replies would be quite short. I remember expressing concern to my ex-husband about, I don't know what's going on here, why this friend has suddenly become aloof, but he didn't say anything to me. And it was only after we had decided to separate and I got in touch with this friend to let him know that he told me that the last time they'd come to visit us and my ex-husband had given them a lift back to the place where they were staying, they'd had to listen to a very long and intense climate skeptic rant. And these were people who were the original greenies, I guess, for want of a better word. The whole family was always very environmentally conscious and environmentally aware, like way back before anyone else had heard of it, even before it became as widely spoken about as it is now. They were so shocked that they couldn't really bring themselves to get in touch again. But because they'd assumed that I was in agreement, they didn't really know what to do about it. And it was only after it was safe for them to talk about it that I heard about it. That's one family that I know about, and I don't know how many others there are.
I wonder also, we were talking a bit about the when and the happenstance and life happening and diagnoses and moves, etc. I do want to get into what you think promotes someone's interest and openness to this kind of thinking, if they've had certain experience where they felt like they couldn't trust, or if they're more prone to anxiety and this is where it comes out. Curious about what your insights are about that, because I wonder There's so much that government does that we don't know about. And there's so much that's happening under our noses, behind our backs, all of it. And things that we come to find out years later, people who were being tested on for different experiments and really horrific things. But it's also interesting, just as someone also who's Jewish, that there's so many conspiratorial groups that devolve into anti-Semitism. And you sort of wonder what that is about and why that keeps happening and why there are all these anti-Semitic tropes, Jews being up to things and pulling the strings and et cetera. And I know that there was someone who got involved in the Flat Earth movement and then left. He was Jewish. He left just because it became this place of anti-Semitism. And he never expected that to happen. But these conspiratorial thinking theories start to weave themselves in with other ones that have just been around for millennia. But I'm curious about what you understand about him that made him open in a way that you weren't.
I think that's possibly where the personality style comes into it. Obviously, it's something that I've spent many hours over many years looking into. And the one thing that comes up time and time again, and I think it's been shown in multiple studies, is that there is a strong link between a narcissistic personality style and the tendency to believe in conspiracy theories. With that narcissistic personality style, from what I understand, you have a genetic predisposition, which may or may not be expressed. And what allows that genetic predisposition to be expressed is what can be loosely termed a lack of control environment growing up. That might be the dynamic between the parents or peripatetic childhood, or there's all sorts of different factors that can affect that. I think those things were present for him. And certainly a lot of the behaviors that I have witnessed fall under that umbrella of a narcissistic personality style, pretty much without a doubt.
It's an interesting thing about narcissism, because one of the things that I've noticed comes out when people have these kinds of diagnoses is it's very hard for them to take accountability for things. They will blame others for things not working out in their life, blame others for things not working out in a marriage, that it's because of the other person. But also this need for specialness and this need to have a superiority, the need to feel like you have something other people don't. And in this situation, that somehow you have the answer, that you have found the key. Do you feel like that was part of it for him?
Yeah, and knowing better than everyone else. What I initially thought to be confidence turned out to be arrogance. There was never any question that he was right. That if somebody disagrees with me about something or gives me a different point of view, I immediately think, oh, maybe I'm wrong, or maybe I need to look at that differently. Whereas he is the complete opposite. It's always, no, they're wrong. Always. And I used to be really impressed by that certainty and that confidence, because I didn't have it. As time goes on, I thought, it's actually really rigid.
Isn't it, though? That's a perfect word for it, because they talk about how a healthy mind is a flexible mind, like the scientific model. Based on new evidence, we are going to now incorporate that and shift how we felt about this and how we looked at this, because now we have new information. An inflexible mind is not a healthy one, but it does come across as very sure. And there are a lot of people who are drawn in by that sense of absolute clarity, or what seems like absolute clarity, but it really is just digging your heels in because you can't be wrong. You don't know where it's coming from, but if it's coming from insecurity because it seems like security, and that your mind, the way you look at things, would be considered much more healthy. It might come across to someone who is very sure as being unsure, but really you're open to new information, which is, again, how people start to think about the world in new ways based on the article they read or the new evidence of something or the conclusion of a study, whatever else. That's how it is for a lot of people, but that's a risk. That's almost like, for people who are more narcissistic, that's taking too great of a risk to change your mind.
It just became more and more difficult to get anywhere in terms of having a conversation. It never was a conversation. It was always a lecture. It's interesting just seeing how far back that feeling of being lectured went, because when I was tidying up some boxes of papers quite recently, I came across a diary back from 2014. And I written these notes about how I was feeling belittled and lectured, and that any conversation would really turn into him explaining to me how the world works and not answering openly any questions that I might have about it. And I had that sense of being talked down to and patronized way back then. And I think that was when I really started thinking, well, maybe he doesn't look at me as an equal. I always used to think that he regarded me as an equal intellectually, that I was just as capable of understanding things as he was. There was once upon a time he would ask me what I thought about things or how I understood things, but that all stopped. I think that was the moment that I realized that my opinions and insights are worthless in his mind.
Worthless and maybe silly, or what was conveyed?
I wouldn't say silly. It was just unenlightened, that I didn't understand how the world worked and I hadn't seen the truth yet. I wanted to use the word naive, but I'd be wary of that, because I think in some ways I probably was naive and maybe still am. That's just something that I need to learn to manage a bit better.
What does it mean to be naive?
Trusting, I think, would be the word.
I think so. I think this is a phrase that I've used before on the podcast, but I think about this, that we assume that what's true for us is true for other people, even after we've been given a lot of proof that that's not the case. We still think someone else might be reasonable. Someone is saying something that is the truth. If you feel like you wouldn't say something with so much assurance that it's the absolute truth, unless you really knew it for a fact, then you're going to assume that's the case for other people as well.
And that's exactly it. Like, I had several years, and I know that I've already said a similar thing, of thinking that I must be missing something because he was so sure that I considered him to be a decent person that had everyone's best interests at heart, including mine and the rest of the families. And I would say to myself, he would not be so sure and saying these things if it weren't true. And I kept on looking, except that it wasn't there.
Except that it wasn't there, right. So there was a story one time that some people may have heard me mention. It was in relation to this cultic group. And then I want to talk about the cult-like part of this also. This cultic group called Heaven's Gate in San Diego, where they all committed suicide so they could go up to the mothership that was supposed to be traveling behind a comet. And they went to a telescope shop in San Diego and pooled their resources and bought one of the most powerful telescopes, put it together, and directed it at the comet that was making its way closer and closer to the Earth to look for this mothership. that was supposedly flying behind it, which is what the leader said. And a few days later, they brought the telescope back to the shop and said that it was broken because it didn't see the mothership. And so you, as Dr. Margaret Singer, who is a pioneer in this field, would say that when you're involved in an organization or in relationship or in an environment where you're being manipulated and you want something to be true, you will learn to deny the evidence of your senses. Because you weren't in that realm, you couldn't find the proof and the evidence, but somehow he could, which is so interesting. What our mind's eye can see, can find if we want to see it.
I was experiencing a lot of confusion, or I guess you might call it cognitive dissonance, because on the one hand, I had this person who I considered to be a decent guy, but on the other hand, none of it made sense, and I was feeling increasingly uncomfortable and undervalued, I suppose, in the relationship. So I had all of those things going on at once. But I think the further down the rabbit hole he went, the more uncomfortable and out of place I started feeling in my own home and in that relationship.
And so there's this distance that becomes a gulf. There isn't a bridge across.
No, even before the pandemic, it became harder and harder to just have a relaxed conversation about anything because they would always end up talking about very intense and very dark things. And I had found that I was avoiding situations where we might sit down and chat. I did actually say to him at one point that it has become almost as if we're flatmates. What do we talk about apart from who's going to pick which child up from where and what we're going to have for dinner?
Yes, just the practicalities, but without emotion, without connection. And with children, I know to whatever degree you feel comfortable sharing, you know, we haven't talked about that familial impact. So I don't know what you feel comfortable being open about with that.
It's something that I'm still unraveling in my own mind. I think the full extent of the impact is something that might take a long time to reveal. You know, it's only with the distance that I'm beginning to understand it better, and I think them as well. My middle child, my daughter, has said that she used to really enjoy having interesting conversations with her dad, and that it went from him being open to challenging the status quo and looking at things a different way and introducing new ideas, which was very healthy. The two of them used to have some very interesting debates. And she said that over time, that changed to being told what to think, which was my experience as well. And that she'd noticed that it was when he started introducing really wacky ideas about lizard aliens, and there were pictures of crop circles going up on the walls in the office and that sort of thing, that's when she noticed a shift in it. And our youngest son was exposed to quite a lot of these alternative ideas, and some of it still causes me a great deal of difficulty to talk about it, but I have spoken about it on the radio and I mention it in the book, that there was some, what effectively is a form of Holocaust denial, revisionism and minimization of what actually happened. Things like questioning the 6 million figure and questioning the existence of gas chambers and those sorts of things that our son was then repeating at school. It's something that I really struggle with. One of the things that's come out of it that is really good and backs up a lot of the research in the area is that what a lot of the experts say about getting somebody off that path towards conspiratorial ideation is that you take emotion out of the conversation, that you ask gentle questions about how would it even work and what sort of people would be interested in that kind of thing. That didn't work for me in my intimate relationship, but I did notice that it worked really well for him with that couple of degrees of separation. So with his teacher and other friends were able to successfully ask those questions of him. And they did it in a very patient and understanding way that got him off that path, which I think is very heartening, very humbling. Some of those people are still his friends today. The other really wonderful thing about it is that they didn't judge him badly for that, that they remained open-minded about it. And I think the other thing that struck me with it is that even, I think they would have been about year 10, I can't remember what, probably about 15, I suppose, that even at that age, somehow they knew which things they could pull his leg about and which things were more serious. So, for example, with the Princess Diana theory, they would laugh about that and joke. With the Holocaust stuff, there was no joking. It was all serious questions. And I thought, well, isn't that wonderful? I have a lot of very mixed feelings about all of that, but there's certainly some very positive things that came out of it. But from my point of view, I still feel terrible that he was in a home environment where he was exposed to those sorts of ideas. But, you know, at the same time, he chose not to believe it.
That's incredible, actually.
There's a BBC reporter called Mariana Spring, who's done a lot of work on disinformation and conspiracy theories and how the online world works. And I seem to remember her saying that even young people who grow up in that sort of environment do not necessarily take on those views. I might check that so I don't misattribute that to her, but I'm pretty sure.
One of the things that I've noticed is that there are people who will find themselves diving in and then something snaps them back out of it. It's not being argued with. It's being maybe presented with other information, or when they hear themselves saying something suddenly and they're wondering, oh, I don't like the way I'm sounding actually right now. There was a man who originally was from Australia who became involved in QAnon.
Was that Jitart?
Yeah.
I listened to that interview that you did with him.
He got involved out of a need to have a connection with his father, which is so interesting. And you see the wanting to adopt the same kind of talking points and beliefs so that you have that commonality. And it's hard because then you're worried about leaving that, because then are you leaving the relationship? That's not easy.
No, and it's something I have talked to my son about, because he did find it difficult deciding that his father was wrong. For a while, I underestimated just how difficult that would have been for an adolescent boy to decide that his dad was wrong.
That's very hard. I wonder also if not believing that people were killed in the Holocaust and not believing that in the gas chambers, if that's just an easier way to think, because who wants to believe that all of that took place? Not believing 6 million. You shouldn't actually believe 6 million. It was many more. It was many people. But I wonder how much these beliefs at times feel like they're introducing us to the truth, or how much they're helping us hide from the truth.
That's something that Deborah Lipstadt picked up on in the book, because she talked about a survey that had been done. And she said that the reason that the results were possibly skewed was more to do with the wording of the survey, about it gave people to think that it was such a preposterous thing that maybe it actually wasn't true.
Interesting. So I'm wondering about the cult-like part of it, because when we're dealing with cults, we do have this us versus them. We've already talked about a number of these things and the yes steps. So, you know, if I can get them to believe this, then I can move it up to something more extraordinary. There is this idea that when you get involved in a cultic group, you're being presented with the truth in a way that you've never been presented with it before. And in fact, I remember talking to people who said that they didn't want to be called conspiracy theorists. They wanted to be called conspiracy realists, because then they had the real truth. It's inherently deceptive. I mean, that is sort of the big distinction, I think, between a cultic group and a healthy group, that you really don't know if what you're being told is true at all, and you don't know what the intention is for you and why they want you to be involved and why they want you to be thinking this way. And is it really for your benefit, or is it to grow the organization? Is someone there hoping that the more people they can get to follow them, because they have a narcissistic need to have so many people follow them, that that's the whole reason they're doing everything they can to get people's interest? You just don't know. It's really fascinating that it's just not clear even what the intention is for people who start these organizations or who foster it, further it online. And is it so they can sell generators and underground bunkers and all the parts for that because they make a living? It's very hard to know whom to trust in these situations.
I can see multiple aspects of that, because I think there definitely are some grifters out there, people who are opportunistic and they see a way to either boost their profile and or make money. But at the same time, there are the true believers. I think my ex-husband falls into the true believer category, as do some of the people that he worked with on these articles and videos. From my perspective, that possibly makes them more dangerous, because they really did think that they are saving lives in the process during the pandemic.
So the ones who really are the true believers and feel that they are saving lives can be more dangerous, and exactly right, that there are people who said that I was given this idea from a young age that I was supposed to save people. I was supposed to keep them from going to hell. I was supposed to make sure that their soul was on the right track. And I then had this mission, and people will say I became obnoxious, but I really felt like I can't miss an opportunity, because I'm doing a disservice, I'm doing an injustice, I'm not giving someone an opportunity to be saved. Going back to what you were saying, that you just didn't know what was going to come out of his mouth, this is what happens. Just feel like, oh, I'm in front of someone who I need to tell the truth to, because I would feel wrong not imparting this information on them.
Yeah, and that ties in again with this idea of the false self, that if you've constructed a belief of yourself or an image of yourself as a morally upstanding person who has everyone's best interests at heart, and you believe that the COVID vaccines are killing people, then it is your duty to speak about it loud and often and to not let up in that process.
Right, that it would be wrong of you not to do that. And for the others, like you, it's cringeworthy. It's very hard.
Cringeworthy, but also personally offensive. There were numerous occasions during the pandemic where awful things were said to me. I had one email telling me that if I were to go along with the agenda of our government and its sycophants, then I, along with others like me, would be guilty of a crime against humanity.
Oh my.
It's pretty full on. Yeah, I had lots of that sort of thing. So that challenges my perception of myself as well, because I don't think I am that person. But when you are being told by somebody who you thought loved you or was your life partner that you are basically evil, then that really cuts to the core. And I had lots of instances of that. You know, I'd be told that I was dishonest and deluded, psychotic. There was one term, the mass formation psychosis, that became fashionable.
Interesting. I don't know that term. What is it? Mass formation psychosis?
There's a term called mass formation, which actually is a standard term in psychology. And then I think it was possibly Robert Malone on a Joe Rogan podcast who added in the term psychosis. So the mass formation psychosis then became a go-to term in some of the conspiracy theory circles. And it was basically what I view to be like a thought-terminating cliche of sorts. It's a way of shutting down any kind of conversation or debate that if you're suffering, if anyone who disagrees with us is suffering from this form of psychosis, then we are the right ones and everyone else is basically mentally unwell. And there is a Belgian psychologist called Matthias Desmet, who also became very popular in some of those conspiracy theory groups. And I was invited to watch videos of his. And the conclusion of that was that basically the people who aren't awake are suffering from this form of psychosis. So that was something that I would hear a lot. And it would be directed at me personally that, you know, I was either guilty of a crime against humanity or that I was mentally unwell, dishonest, and all of these other things. It actually became very personal and offensive and cut to the core of who I thought I was and what our relationship was, in a way that you can't unsee that or you can't overlook it or avoid it. And that's part of the cult dynamic, I think. You're either in or you're out. And the us versus them mentality and the one true path, and that you're either on the path or you're not. And I wasn't on the path at the time.
I'm wondering if there were other points that you wanted to make sure to make about this whole scene, about how this all happens, and also if there are certain directions you feel like it's going in now that people need to be aware of, if there are certain buzzwords that turn out to be conspiratorial, kind of have a conspiratorial origin, and people might not even know at this point, just what you can educate us about.
One of the things that I keep coming back to is, what could I have done differently? Is there anything that I could have done to stop him going down that path? And looking back, I'm not sure. I don't think there was. But I do hold a lot of store by what happened with our son, and that that does fit with what a lot of the experts in the field say. So the conclusion that I have come to with it all is that the gentle questioning and the trying to understand, a lot of conspiracy theories are built on very real fears, and there is pretty much always a kernel of truth at the heart of them, or it's based on something that most of us are afraid of in some way or another, and that's not something that can be dismissed. So some sort of gentle questioning to get to the heart of what that is and how it would work, how did this originate and who benefits from it, and those sorts of things are all really valuable. But based on what I've experienced with my ex-husband and my son's experience at school, I think it's better if there's at least one emotional layer removed from it. So maybe not a close family member doing it, either a friend or a teacher or somebody a little bit further away that can be trusted. Because by the time I had found, you were talking about the anti-Semitic nature of a lot of the conspiracy theories, and I had found some images of Nazi era cartoons, some from France and a Russian one, I think, from the turn of the 19th to the 20th century, that had hands clasping a globe and the puppet strings and all of those things. And I could put those side by side with new images that are out now showing basically exactly the same thing, only puppet strings with Jacinda Ardern as the puppet or something like that. And there was the Mia One mural that was a reformulation of some of those things. And I had all of those photographs documented to show my ex-husband and say, look, it's the same. Can't you see it's the same stuff? But by the time we'd got to that stage, it was too late. It was all over. It's just trying to keep the humanity, but at a distance is really the best advice I can offer. It's really, really difficult in a one-on-one intimate relationship. So I think the more people who are aware of it all and who could see the difference in disinformation and what's real, one of the keys is how it makes you feel. That if a piece of information brings up very strong emotions, using very emotive language, then that is worth checking out because it may not be real. And I think Finland, are doing a lot of work with their young people to educate them about critical thinking and learning to differentiate good information from bad information, those sorts of things. I think that would help.
I love this. I'm actually going to write this down about how a piece of information makes you feel. There is so much that the media uses to catch people's attention. Headlines, with the amount of seconds that people devote to having focus these days. And they say they, if you're going to put an advertisement out, you have to catch someone in the first like 3 seconds. So it's the same thing with headlines. It's the same thing with getting people's attention. But to see how it makes you feel, if you're suddenly feeling panicked or if you're feeling something, it could even be that there isn't even an emotion yet tied to it, but you're noticing maybe your heart is racing or you're feeling a tightness somewhere in your body that was potentially manufactured. It could be that it's real. It could be that you're reading something that really is bothersome to you or very exciting to you, and that's very genuine. But it could also be that you were caught up and purposely brought into a fever pitch and to wonder why. Like, what do they want from you? That's a great piece of advice. I really like that.
Another one is, what would happen if you challenged that group? That's something that is relevant to a personal relationship, but also a group dynamic. If you disagree with them or perceive a problem with it, watch what happens. Because if you are then the problem rather than the point you've made, that is a significant red flag.
It's interesting too, because we're going into the realm of narcissism. And that's a piece of advice that I find myself giving people who are very charmed by someone who other people find too slick or there's something off about them, but you're so drawn in that you might not notice. And so I'll sometimes say, test, even gently, just say, oh, I'm actually not available tonight if you're asked out. Or you say maybe instead of absolutely yes to something and see how they take it. That's it. So interesting.
it's a useful point for narcissism, but also for the conspiracy theory and cult-like dynamics, that if it gets turned back on you, then be very wary.
It has been so good to speak with you, and I'm so happy. I don't know if that says to the degree that I mean it. I really value that you've taken your experience as a way to educate the public, to let people know that this is something to look at, and that also that they're not alone in their experience, that you've been through this and there are many others as well. And so I really think it's wonderfully strong and brave and a lot of things that you've come forward with your story. I really, truly appreciate it. And I appreciate the time today.
Thank you very much. It's been lovely talking to you.
Really lovely. And I wish you well.
Thank you.
One more thing before you go. It is so powerful to speak with people like Louise who are willing to come forward with their story, as difficult as it is. I mean, when it's your lived experience and you needed to weather a storm that was a huge storm and growing storm, as a lot of conspiracy theories talk about the storm coming, it's actually a storm a lot of times that they create. It's not something that's coming from the outside. It's something that they get cultivated to actually bring into their home, like their own personal tornado. I'm so glad that Louise was able to join us today on the show and talk about her experience, her children's experience, and all that she's learned. It is a hard-won achievement when it has come with so much pain, so much confusion, suddenly seeing a person who you thought you knew in a very different light. The confusing part is that they think they're seeing you in a different light. They think they're suddenly seeing you as closed-minded, as having blinders on, as being stupid, being naive. They think that you are revealing something about yourself rather than they are revealing something about themselves, and you haven't changed at all. That is one of the things that is very hard, because there's sort of this inherent gaslighting in these moments where people who are willing to be introspective and take things on for size will wonder, maybe I have changed. Maybe I am being closed-minded. Maybe I need to open myself up to this. Very often, they'll have other people in their world, if they're still in contact with other people, who will say, you're fine and you're the same. It's that now you're dealing with someone whose mind is much more open to ideas that you don't think are rooted in reality. That's the only change that's happened. It wasn't on your part. But I think what's so interesting is when we were talking at the end about how to discern if you are possibly being manipulated, there was this point, actually two points, that she brought up at the end about check to see how a piece of information affects you, how it impacts you emotionally, physiologically. And the next point is, what happens if you challenge the group's teachings or you challenge that person and what they believe? It's not even so much that you have to challenge. You just might say, I don't know, not sure about that. And that can feel like you are being confrontative and argumentative and abusive and closed-minded, and you'll get called a lot of things that are very dramatic and for not having done something very dramatic. You'll be reminded over and over again that the person you're talking to doesn't have the patience for dissension, doesn't have the ability to incorporate a differing view into their shifting and much more narrow worldview. And so you are now going to be the outlier. You're outside of this sphere that has been created for them, that they just decided to dive right into, or they were manipulated into diving into. But there isn't a space for you in there anymore. And it's very hard when the person who you've been with is suddenly treating you like you are this hostile outsider and you're someone who might be trying to take something away from them. When you check in with yourself to see how something makes you feel, make sure that you're not waiting until you have the words to describe how it makes you feel, because sometimes what registers is how it makes us feel physically. There was someone who said to me, I found that when I spent time with this other person who always wanted to talk to me about what the government was up to, that my body would get hot. And I don't know if it's that they were getting me so riled up, or there was so much that I disagreed with that I couldn't say, that it was accumulating inside of me and I felt like I was going to burst, but my cheeks would get red or I'd start to sweat. And that was my way of noticing that something here felt wrong and I didn't have the words for it yet. Or if at the end of each conversation, suddenly you're made to feel like you're dumb, you're naive, you're closed-minded, there's something wrong with you, notice that too. If that's not how that person made you feel in the past, or if that's not really how you felt in the past about yourself or anyone in your world would have felt about you, notice that there is this X in that equation, and it might not be you. It could be this other person who is changing, who is making you feel that way. It could be the group of people that that person is exposing themselves to and those kinds of teachings that is the X in the equation. That's the thing that's changed. Again, not you. You're reacting to a shift. I don't think the shift came from inside of you. But if something makes you feel bad, if something also makes you feel worried, there are a lot of people who have their finger on the pulse of things that are being hidden from the general population. Those are the things that they target when they're looking at news. And so they'll tell you about things that governments are up to. And sometimes they're absolutely correct. And it can make you so angry. And it can make you feel like you have to stay on top of things and that you can't trust. And so whenever you have a conversation with them, you feel like, oh no, I'm living in a world where people are taking advantage of me and people are just hoping that I just keep trusting them, even though they don't deserve it. And so many people are up to so many bad things. Notice if you only feel that way after talking to that person. And it could be, again, that because they have worked, let's say, for the FBI or the CIA, they have some background intel. And it's disturbing, and it's true. Or if you say, where did you get this information? And they cite an online source. Then you want to notice that that person who is getting worked into a froth is now working you into a froth. And they love being able to do that to you, because one of the things that people who are involved in conspiracy kind of theories don't like to feel is they don't want to feel alone. They already start to feel separated from the rest of the world. And so they don't want to feel alone in their conspiratorial thinking too. So the more people they can get to join them in this new world, this new reality, the more they feel better and cushioned, the less different they feel, and the more validated they feel that maybe these teachings are correct, and these viewpoints are correct, because after all, they got someone who they respect, who they think is bright, to feel the same way. You also then want to notice what happens if you disagree. Because if someone has a healthy sense of competency, they don't mind if you disagree. It doesn't affect them. They know what they know, they feel confident about it, and you can see it that way or not. But if someone just cannot tolerate you disagreeing, and if they put you down and get hostile and mean and insulting towards you, then that's coming from a very different place. Not quiet confidence, not the sort of lovely sense of competency, but it's coming sometimes from insecurity, because if they respect you and your mind, and you're questioning what they're believing, then do they have to notice that maybe they're believing something that's not true and they don't want to have to notice that? Or you might be dealing with someone who has narcissistic personality disorder, who cannot tolerate ever being made to feel wrong or less than, or off track, or just not superior. You want to know if it's safe for you to have your own viewpoint, for you to say, I don't really see it that way. Because that's a relationship that you can stay in. That's a relationship that is flexible. That's a relationship that doesn't have these strict walls around it, but instead is more like a rubber band that can be stretched, where there's space made, there's room made for dissenting views. And that's sort of, I think, the healthiest way to be in the world, where you make space for people to have differing views. But you don't have to keep making space for people who keep insulting you, making you wrong, putting you down, making it unsafe for you to be with them. Thank you so much to Louise for her insights, for taking the time to speak with us today, but also for her book and all that she puts out there that can help countless others who are trying to navigate this very confusing space. Take good care. Talk to you next week.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @indoctrinationpodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.